37 Disney Street, which isn't far from you, three Disney fans have watched a film which they will now review.
Hello friends and welcome to 37 Disney Street. We're in full festive swing right now in the house and the kids are throwing snowballs instead of throwing heads as we settle down by the fire to talk about 1993's Nightmare Before Christmas. I am the one with a tearaway face. I'm Chris Fletcher.
You've been putting deadly nightshade in my tea again. I'm Lucy Rain.
Bunny!
Hello children, I'm Hugh Rain.
Chris.
Happy Christmas to you too.
Happy Christmas.
Do you feel important at this time of year because it's Christmas?
Because it's my mass.
It's your
my
mass.
Yes. Yes, I feel very important.
We're well into it now, well into Advent.
I'm wearing, appropriately I would say, my black and orange Halloweeny scarf.
Mm-hmm.
Yet my Christmas beddy socks.
Beautifully done, Hugh.
My feet are very warm because I've actually got some real socks underneath them. My feet are getting quite hot right now.
So
jealous.
So Nightmare Before Christmas then.
Mm.
Oh yeah.
The first question I have to ask before we go into anything is this:
Is it
a Christmas film or is it a Halloween film?
I was going to ask the same thing. Right. Look, I can see both arguments. Right. I can even see you saying, well, it's a bit of both. But if that's the case, I think it's 40% Halloween, 60% Christmas, maybe even more. I would say it's a Christmas film.
Okay.
I'm going to go really, third wheel here. But it was released on the 29th of October. Now, if you're aiming for a Halloween market, that's a bit late.
Okay.
So I think it is intended as a November film, and I like it as a November film. Because, you've packed all your Halloween stuff away. That's done with. Supermarkets full of advent calendars. I think it's a November film.
Okay, so I have more room for it as a Halloween film, I think, in my viewing calendar is what I would say. But, and I know you're going to talk about stuff in a minute to do with the film, but because the concept of it is, it came about because of the changeover in shops from Halloween to Christmas, I think you're probably right, Lucy. I think that November slot is probably where it sits. So it does sit in between the two.
It's all about what box you've got out of the garage, I think.
Yes, yes.
I find watching a film with Halloween elements in it at Christmas less objectionable than watching a film at Halloween with Christmas elements in it.
Interesting.
So therefore, I would rather watch this at Christmas.
We got it on VHS. I'll say we... Si got it on VHS in 1994.
That's his brother.
Yes, my brother. The same year that Jurassic Park came out on VHS, and we got both of them for Christmas.
Oh, what a Christmas.
Yeah. But it meant that there wasn't a lot of space even then for Nightmare Before Christmas. So Si used to watch it quite a lot, but I didn't.
Oh.
And so it became not Christmas for me. And the reason I've watched it more recently was because of my trip to Disneyland last year. And that last year was probably the first time I've watched this film since I was in my teens. And I watched it at Halloween. So that's probably why it feels more Halloween-y to me.
I watched this, I think, last Boxing Day or something. And it's the first time in a long time that I've just sat and just watched a film and focused on it and just really enjoyed it.
Mm.
And I loved it. And then we had to do that again this time because we're making notes for this show. And I just love just sitting and looking at it.
I saw this at the cinema when it came out. I was 11. What? And it was the first time that my parents had dropped me and my friend off, gone away, and we'd gone in and bought our own tickets. And
were you
sat
scared?
Down. Well, it is a little bit exhilarating when you're 11. You know, do you all remember that kind of phrase in your life?
Yeah, that was that the Flintstones stuff. Film for me.
Exciting.
Little Mermaid for me.
So yeah, and I did not like it.
Okay.
In 1993, I did not like it.
Did you find it scary? Or just weird?
Just grubby.
Yeah, okay.
Danny Elfman came out a couple of weeks ago Right, quite appropriately.
Out of the closet?
No. The Metro, I think, ran this and they were saying...
Came out of the Metro.
Listen. The Metro said, Danny Elfman has spoken. He's decided once and for all. And because I feel so strongly that this is a Christmas film, I thought, oh, he's going to say it's Halloween. And he did. But what he said was, and it's quite inconclusive, he said, it's obviously about Christmas, but for me, it's a Halloween movie. Which is inconclusive, isn't it, really?
It's not and also, once and for all, is
it? Also, like saying, oh, this one guy who worked on it, I know he's, you know, one of like the three main guys who worked on it, you know, art director, director, and, you know, music. I don't think you can say, look, he has spoken, therefore that this is true. That doesn't fly with me.
I would also argue that the film itself is Halloween does Christmas, and if they're doing Christmas, then it's a Christmas film.
Yeah.
I'm sold on the fact that it is probably more Christmas than it is Halloween, but I think that Lucy's right. I think it sits in
He steals somewhere. Christmas, so it's a Christmas film.
I will not sit down to wrap my presents to this. I won't put this on Christmas Eve. I won't put it on when we're decorating the tree because it just doesn't feel happy, happy, joyful, joyful Christmas to me.
Fair enough.
I will watch it in November. I think it's a very good getting ready for Christmas.
It's a gateway Christmas.
It is a gateway, yeah.
That sounded like she was telling you when you're allowed to watch it, Hugh.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Too late, I've already watched it.
We will not be watching this when we are wrapping presents.
We don't wrap presents together. I mean, how would you do that?
Would not wrap each other's.
Interesting.
Tell us the facts, Lucy.
Oh, do you know what? Twitter people, we do like you. Do let us know what you think about this.
Mm.
Like, do you think it's a Christmas film or a Halloween film? I'll try not to disagree with you.
As long as you say Christmas.
I'm not just going to go, wrong.
Facebook people can tell us as well if they want.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Fair enough.
And Hugh won't be able to ding you, so you're fine. You can watch it in April if you want.
I can ding him.
Right, this was released, as has already been stated, on the 29th of October, 1993. Excuse me while I turn my page. It was directed by Henry Selick.
Yeah, a lot of people think it's Tim Burton.
I thought it was Tim Burton till this afternoon.
Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas isn't directed by Tim Burton.
It's
I didn't know that, actually.
You didn't know?
No, I did know that.
You did know that? Yeah. Oh, good.
I discovered it not this afternoon, but yesterday morning.
Oh, really?
There you go. Somebody else.
I never thought to question it.
No, of course you wouldn't. Why would you?
But there's a lot of reasons why you wouldn't question it.
It's still basically
well.
His film, but he's got someone at the helm directing it.
Because he was too busy with Ed Wood.
Well, yeah, we'll come to that. It's it makes me feel a little cross at him. Anyway, it was produced and conceived by Tim Burton. It is a stop-motion animation. We know all this. There's a brilliant extra features on the DVD that explains how stop-motion is done.
Do you know that sketch?
For anyone who doesn't know.
Do you remember that sketch from The Fast Show? With like a fake Wallace and Gromit and he says,
oh, yeah.
And move it just a tiny amount. Take a couple of pictures, then move it just a tiny amount. And I said to Lucy today, because we watched that, I said, I feel like everybody knows this now. fair enough, it was 93, but like, I don't think we ever need to be shown again how animation works.
Do you know what? Maybe this CG generation that we're raising now, maybe Bonnie and Lucas and Ollie in a few years' time, it'll boggle the mind that we used to do stuff like this.
Could do. The painstaking process.
Yeah, it's like that's bonkers.
Yeah, there we go.
It's like when you hear that people used to use mangles. My grandma used to have a mangle, and I'm like, what? Why did you need a mangle?
People still use mangles.
They do at car washes. We're getting off the subject a bit, aren't we?
Not just in car washes, but yes.
So, scroll back to the year I was born, 1982, and Tim Burton is working for Walt Disney Feature Animation.
Mm.
And at the time... playing around with a few concepts, he wrote a poem that was basically this film.
Just out of interest, have you seen any of the concept art for the Black Cauldron that he did?
No.
I'm sure we'll talk about this when we come to the Black Cauldron, but it looks like Tim Burton's drawings, unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
It's freaky. The stuff he's drawn is freaky and
would not have played.
No.
I was going to say, I don't know.
I mean, it's a concept art. I suppose the concept art wasn't there for... Alice in Wonderland from that British guy, and that was really scary, yeah. Freaky stuff. So I guess it's just to get ideas for what they eventually go with. But all very Tim Burton. I just wanted to say because it's important to me, this, because I have a quote, because the other thing he worked on was Fox and the Hound. And here's a quote from Tim Burton.
Every fox needs is black and white stripes.
Now, I couldn't find any concept art for this. I looked all over the place and I couldn't find any. And then I found this quote from Tim Burton himself. I couldn't draw those four-legged Disney foxes. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't even fake the Disney style. Mine looked like roadkills. I think that sums up Tim Burton's drawing in general.
I can imagine that. So he was working for Disney Feature Animation, and he wrote this poem, and it got put in file. Him and his mate, Henry Selick, also working at Disney, did a bit of concept art, messed around with it, a bit of a treatment. Was it going to be a TV movie? Was it going to be a straight-to-video? Was it going to be nothing? And then it just got left on the books. Eventually, Tim Burton left the Walt Disney Company. Was he sacked?
Yes. He was overheard in the canteen saying naughty things about...
To Gerald.
Was he called Gerald?
I've done it again.
To Jeffrey.
How often do I call Jeffrey?
Jeffrey was very old at that age.
I've seen some things in my time with you and the young'uns. You don't speak a bad word about Mr. Disney there, or I'll report you to HR. I just want to say that, little Tim Burton.
So Jeffrey got Tim Burton sacked.
Mm-hmm.
You heard it here first.
Wow.
What
was Tim Burton actually talking about?
This might be an urban legend, but I heard he'd been like, I don't know. I'm sure it was something. He was saying horrible things about Mickey Mouse or something. I could be wrong.
You see, I wanted to look a bit more into this, but I kind of ran out of time. And they didn't say he got sacked. On what I was reading, it was very euphemistic. It was
Disney
like...
Disney never do.
Yeah, it
because
was like...
Because when they cancel a TV series, they sunset it.
Yeah, it was an acrimonious decision to leave the company or a party. You know, it was kind of put like that, so I don't know.
So what it says here, and this is literally the first thing I've come across, was that he was sacked because his short film Frankenweenie was too scary for children.
Yeah, whatever.
I mean, the concept and the things that he was doing that probably were seen as that. And I don't know if you've seen any of the Frankenweenie film, but it's...
You don't know what contract he was
the new
under.
One,
no, the live-action original one that's got...
Vincent Price? No.
No, that's the Vincent stop-motion short that he did. No, it's got the woman from The Shining in it.
Shelley Duvall,
yeah. And the big brother from... Wonder Years, whose name escapes me, Jason something.
Thing is, you don't know what kind of contract he was under. If he was under short contract terms, like 6 months terms, as a concept artist, and they looked at his work and said, you know what, this doesn't fit our in-house style, I can see him just being let go. So it's all very, very vague about that. Anyway, so it didn't hurt him at all, because he went on and made Edward Scissorhands and Beetlejuice in the intervening years. And then... He decided he wanted to do something with his poem again. This idea kept resurfacing. But of course, Disney owned it, basically. It had gone in their filing cabinet. This wasn't a scam or anything. He had worked for them doing concept art at the time. So he approached them and said, you know me, little me who used to make the tea, I'm big and famous now, and I really want my work back. Can we strike a deal? And that's how this came to be a Disney property. However... Disney felt it was a little bit too dark. They were really exclusively, the animation department was exclusively doing family films at the time. They weren't very comfortable with it, so it's released as a Touchstone picture. In 2006, when it was re-released, it was released by Disney Animation, Disney Movie Studios, or whatever it was called at the time. Because, you know, they'd been comfortable with it. It was a cult hit by that time. So, Tim Burton and longtime collaborator Danny Elfman sat down together to work through the story. They were using a lot of the original concept art that Tim Burton had done when he was at Disney. And Tim Burton was sketching as they spoke. So he was able to give visual references to Danny Elfman all the way through the process. But... I think we're going to talk in detail about the animation and the music later on. But during this process, he would kind of say, they didn't have a script. And he would say, oh, at this point, Jack's feeling really down, and so he decides that he's going to do X, Y, Z. And so Elfman would then go away that afternoon slash evening and write a song to do with that. And I think a lot of these kind of, this vagueness of what's happening in the story kind of comes through in certain elements of the music.
They shot a lot of it, a lot of the music numbers first, didn't they? Because they didn't have a script in place.
Yeah, they did a lot of the sequences, and also the script, which was eventually written by Caroline Thompson. She wrote the screenplay. According to Henry Selick, there's hardly any of her original lines left because they were on the move, working so constantly. They were conceiving things with their fingers as they were animating these objects, that they were just calling actors in to redo lines, and there's really basically hardly anything left of her script. So it is what do you call it? A treatment. It's a story treatment by Tim Burton, basically done on the hop by the animation team.
Yeah.
With a little bit of script writing here and there, I think. And that, I think that's why the musical numbers were done first. It was the first animated film to be fully converted to 3D in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Not seen it in 3D.
No.
And there are 109...
I bet it's good in 3D.
I bet it is, actually. I bet this really works it. 109,440 frames in the film.
Wow.
That's how many photographs them took.
And it took them 3 weeks to do a minute or something.
I think it was a week.
Was it a week to do a minute? Yeah.
It was... They set up their own studio.
Just a little bell for you there.
A little bell.
A quiet one, yeah.
Okay. They set up their own studio, especially for this project in San Francisco, where they worked for 3 years with a full staff.
That's where the three came from. It took 3 years to make.
Yes.
And during those 3 years, Tim Burton visited the set a total of, it is estimated, between 8 and 10 days.
Heavily involved in Tim Burton's The Nightmare.
He really, once he'd sort of come up with the concept, because like I say, even the script wasn't done when he left it alone. He gave them his concept art. He gave them his story treatment and he flew the nest. So this is very familiar to anyone who's listened to our podcast with the point when Walt Disney started playing with trains, all those films.
He was doing Batman Returns and Ed Wood at the time, wasn't he?
He was in pre-development for Ed Wood and he was filming Batman Returns at the time.
It's hard to imagine him not being there all the time. He's also actually animating himself almost.
It feels so Tim Burton as well. That's what's funny thing about it to me. But then I guess a lot of the feel of Tim Burton films, certainly in that era, was Danny Elfman as well, wasn't it? There you go. Interesting.
And there's some quotes by Henry Selick saying, it's as if Tim Burton laid an egg and then I was left to sit on it for 3 years. So it's like, I think that he said that affectionately. I think they're very good friends. Oh, They've worked together since. But
he also said, I think we're from the same planet, if not the same neighbourhood.
Yeah.
Well, he went on to do James and the Giant Peach, which has a very similar feel to it. Coraline as well.
Has a cameo from... Jack in it, doesn't it? Well,
both of them do.
I think he did.
Coraline does as well.
Corpse Bride as well.
Jack Skellington's in Coraline.
Jack Skellington is kind of in Coraline. Hmm. Jack Skellington, his head is in the yolk of an egg.
Okay.
Mm.
I accept.
It's like a hidden Mickey, it's a hidden Jack.
Right.
So, when Disney came to release this through Touchstone, they'd got stop motion wasn't terribly popular, except for some weird British company called Aardman. they didn't know if it was a Christmas film or a Halloween film, but the one thing they had was Tim Burton. So it was released as, and I quote, Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas. And that is still what it's called. That's how it's billed. And
do we think that's because Disney were distancing themselves from it, but because Tim Burton was associated with it and the producer for it, that was going to help to sell it, presumably?
I think it really sold it. I think it really sold it. When I found out how little he had to do with it, I became a little bit... just...
annoyed.
Peeved. I'm a little bit cheated, I think.
I've just realised there's no mention of Disney on this cover. There's a little... we've got a DVD here, a special edition. It's got a little hologram, a Disney hologram there, but there's no... I thought it would say Disney somewhere on
it. Well, it was Touchstone, and it was they were the money.
Well, when is this actual copy of the DVD from?
I bet other versions will say Disney on it.
I think they do now. I think they quite proudly own it now.
It doesn't say, actually.
But just to go back to it, James and the Giant Peach is a Disney film, but it wasn't released as Disney in the UK. But it was released as Disney in the US, so it does happen.
Hmm.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So,
well,
we're going to do what we normally do, are we?
And yes,
do,
we are.
Do story, animation and After Eight.
We're going to have a Christmas snack first.
Yay!
Because it's Christmas, and no Christmas, in the UK at least, is complete without a Nestle After Eight.
Did we all open our advent calendars this morning?
I hope you didn't pay too much for that.
Chris, who works at Nestle, they were on offer actually. They were £2.
Two whole English pounds.
For After Eight, a mint chocolate thins, for those who don't know.
I would like three, please.
With individual little pockets that they come in. There you go, there's your three. Yay! That's four there.
It does very clearly say Touchstone Pictures on the back of that DVD, yeah. So it must be a fairly old version of it.
It is a subsidiary of Disney, though, isn't it?
Yes, Touchstone. Yes.
The duo.
Yes.
I never know who owns things and who just... Well, you know, corporate business.
At the moment, Disney pretty much owns everything, I think, the
universe. They own me, if I'm honest.
Oh.
So what were you saying we're going to do? We're going to do our usual thing.
Of the story, the animation, and the after, and the music. Oh, they're a bit heat damaged, these.
Oh, yeah, they've got that sort of grayness.
Yeah, yeah.
Well.
There we are.
Still tastes good.
Oh, yeah, tastes very good.
Today.
They're awesome. So.
Story.
I ate the last of my Halloween candy watching The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Oh.
And a big bag of Lidl Halloween chewy sweets with little cat pumpkins and scarecrows on them. And I finished them off watching this.
Nice.
Quite appropriate. All ready for Christmas now.
Story. Who wants to talk first?
Well, I've talked quite a lot. Let's listen to somebody else.
Go, you. With your mouth full.
What I love about this is that you have this character who's unhappy and he wants more. So he thinks he finds the answer. But it turns out he was happy with his lot all along, right?
Yeah.
But then the comedy comes from the fact that he just gets it so wrong.
Catastrophically wrong.
So for those who don't know, he's he's like in charge of Halloween Town. And they run Halloween. And Halloween's just finished and... they're all celebrating it. And then he wanders off and he's not satisfied. He wants something new. He's bored of it. And then he goes to the forest and he finds this tree he's never seen before because all the trees have doors on for the different lands. And he goes into this one he's never seen before and he discovers Christmas land. And it blows his mind. And he decides this year Christmas will be theirs. Hilarity ensues.
I really like...
It's a great story.
I really like the opening. I like... That the Santa Claus opening, which would have been Patrick Stewart originally, but it ended up not being
the narration
bit at the start. But I also like the very musical opening of the Halloween song that just really sets the scene beautifully. Shows you all those key characters,
yeah.
Gives you a real understanding of what they're like and who they are. It's brilliant.
You get a real sense of fun of the animators as you go along as well. All the
it's really playful.
I think the only weak thing about it is the very first shot. It says Nightmare Before Christmas and it's black and then it cuts to an overhead view of the sort of the big area which the trees are around. And it's just not a very exciting first shot. You think, there'd be some kind of, going through a forest or something, but just a nitpick, just that one thing.
Mm.
You just think, oh, that's your first shot, is it? Come on, guys.
Heavily influenced by German Expressionism, I've got written down here from
interesting.
The art director, which I think you can, that sort of, that... Dark scratchiness, which you see in the forest, that's really, really German Expressionist. That's very Nosferatu.
Also heavily influenced by...
Dr. Seuss.
Well, no, I wasn't going to say Dr. Seuss, but what I was actually going to say was the Frosty the Snowman and the other one, right, Rudolph
Reindeer. Yes. Oh, yeah, that's a good point, actually. I was going to say that. This is... it's harkening back to those days of those Christmas specials, and actually that's one of his Tim Burton's inspirations.
Yes.
For that, and we watch those every year, Bonnie and I. I don't know if you do too.
Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever watched them.
We've got them on DVD. They're some of them are really ropey, but They're classics.
I know them. I'm aware of them. I've seen clips of them, but I don't think I've ever watched them.
And there's things in them like the Burl Ives. Is he called Burl Ives? The snowman in that is... You know that snowman in Elf?
Yes.
Mm. And you think he's very specific. What is he? He's from...
the Santa Claus one.
I don't know. I think it's Rudolph. I think Santa Claus is Fred Astaire.
Oh, yeah.
A really badly animated Fred Astaire.
Oh, that's great. Anyway, I think that this is a really, really good character study. Sorry, I shouldn't have put an after 8 minutes in my mouth just before I started making this point. Excuse me?
I do it all the time on this podcast. Talk whilst eating. Right.
I have an empty mouth now.
That's staying in.
Yeah, it's a really good character study. And it's a good study of power as well, because he's sort of a king in his land and he makes his decision and he takes everybody else with him with his folly, because he has that ability to rule a whole town.
Yeah.
And also the stealing of the authority from the other town, so he can take over that. It's big stuff. It's Game of Thrones, really.
Now, what I always thought about this as a film and what excited me about it and why I quite blindly and happily assumed that Tim Burton was heavily involved in it was because I was a big fan of Beetlejuice and Edward Scissorhands, and the feel of this film is identical. And when you think about, like, I know we'll talk about animation in a bit, but like the diorama bits in Beetlejuice where he's like shrunk down and living in that village, it has real similar feel to what happens in this, and things like that. We see the snake later on in the
orange and
Christmas
black.
Is very much like the ones in the dunes and stuff. So it sets that atmosphere and it makes it feel very, very similar, like it's part of all that world. And I absolutely love that. And for that reason, I really enjoy this story. It's quirky and it's weird, but it's got a lot of heart about it. This at the centre of all of it is a lot of heart, I think.
And there's constant action. There's no sort of dead point, is there? Oh, excuse the pun.
But it's not paced at 100 miles an hour, because that was the other thing that I look at it and think, well, it moves along nicely. And in fact, you go from the Halloween song, if we think about the musical elements, to what's this very, very quickly, probably in the first 15 minutes of the film. But at the same time, you've got some really nice, steady-paced bits with the evil scientist, whatever his name is.
I think he's called Evil Scientist.
Well, he is. He does have a name, though, doesn't he, as well?
Well, the credit...
Finkelstein or something.
Oh, because in the credits it just says Evil Scientist.
It does, yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, there's some nice bits of real kind of lull and steady pace to it. And
there's, like, reflective. There's only one lull for me in this, and that's when he's trying to figure out what Christmas is.
Mm.
You know, he's been there, and he comes back, and he does, like, two numbers about it. And the second one, you think, oh, is he still trying to work this out? And at the end of the song, he's figured it out. Christmas will be ours! But at the start of that song, it's just that just drags a little bit. And that's the only lull for me. Not really criticism, because it's...
I don't see it as a...
The general pace is really good.
Yeah. I don't see it as drag particularly. I really like those bits still, so...
Can I show my hand a bit here? Because I'm going to try to be fair. I don't really like this film very much.
What?
I know, and I know you two really, really do, but it's entirely a personal taste thing. The pop goth thing doesn't appeal to me. The darkness of it, the spikiness of the characters, the grotesqueness, it's just not to my palate particularly. Now, I'm trying to be really fair and look at it as a piece of filmmaking, and so I do think it's very well put together and it's very crafted. But as we go on, I think it's going to become more and more apparent that I just don't like it. And one of the things I don't like is stories that are born from the fact that somebody does things the wrong thing all the time. When you've got a character or a story that's driven by people making poor decisions, it makes for a really frustrating watch.
It's interesting that, because what I think I said in one of the episodes a little while ago about how when I see someone do something wrong for the right reasons, it makes me feel really guilty. That whole sequence where he's taking the presents out and he's putting them, then, you know, he's going and giving out the presents to the kids and he's going down the chimney and stuff. The whole way through that, it makes me feel so uncomfortable and guilty for him, because I'm just like, he's so desperately trying to do something right here and it's going horribly, horribly wrong. But that made me love it even more.
Mm. I'm conflicted watching it because I love his enthusiasm and he's trying to do the right thing, but at the same time, he's doing really naughty things. He's kidnapping Santa Claus.
Mm.
He doesn't know that that's a bad thing to do.
No.
It's all explained away by the fact that he's the Pumpkin King. He is just inherently evil.
King.
And this is quite a positive trait in Halloween Land, to be that evil. So it just comes as second nature to him to do like that. But like when Sally's trying to warn him and, you know, she's had the vision and she's spelling it out for him and he's just ignoring her.
Yeah, but he's just got sort of blind optimism.
Mm, yeah.
But that blind optimism is part of what Sally likes in him as well.
This isn't me criticising the film. This is me kind of explaining why I don't enjoy watching it.
Yeah, it's critiquing it.
But it's weird because, that's kind of the reason I do like it.
I messaged you guys yesterday and said, I'm on a real downer with this film at the moment because I got to this point where I thought, do I only like this film because I'm bought into the hype of it? Because it has become such a big thing with Disney now.
Mm.
You know, they're there at Halloween in the parks. There's clothing everywhere you look. There's toys, there's everything. You know, they've gone all out on the branding. And I just started to think, have I just been taken in by all of this? And actually, it's not as good as I thought. So when I sat down to watch it again yesterday, I felt like I'm not going to enjoy this. And that isn't what happened at all. And I'm genuinely so pleased that that isn't what happened. Because when I watched it properly this time last year, I completely fell in love with it. And I think just that much time had gone by that I was starting to think, I'm not sure.
I think, ironically, it's kind of gone... It's almost like the Disney version of counterculture. You know, if you're not going to be into princesses and mainstream and stuff, but they would still want to get you, they get you with Nightmare Before Christmas, you know, and you see all the, like I say, the pop goths going around with the hoodies on and the backpacks and...
I don't know. I mean, as I say, I'm a huge fan of this era Tim Burton. Up to Big Fish, absolutely love pretty much everything that he'd done. And I think I've talked about this before when we talked about Dumbo on the live action podcast that we did. So for me, this just fits in really, really well with all of that, even though it isn't him that directed it and it wasn't him that ultimately wrote it. I mean, it's still his concept, isn't it?
Mm.
Would you say it's funny?
Bits of it are funny,
because it's not sort of what... It's not sort of hilarious, is it? It's just darkly funny. I think a lot of the humour is just in sort of people getting things wrong and, you know, when that kid pulls the shrunken head out of the box.
Yes, that is... I love
funny
that.
And well-timed. But generally, it's just, you know, when, you know, they're showing the toys that they've made to Jack and, you know, he's telling them how that they can make it better. But, like, what they've done is horrible.
Yes.
And he just shows them how to make it slightly less horrible.
Yeah, Lock, Stock and Barrel are quite amusing, I think. The Mayor is quite an amusing character.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Although he's not laugh out loud. Again, he's just... It's quite subtle humour, I think.
His sad face makes me kind of uncomfortable.
Yeah.
A lot of the humour comes from the very, very small details the animators have put in. Just like when the vampires are wrapping presents and they're all holding umbrellas in one hand and trying to wrap a present with the other hand. And a lot of things like that.
I love that, like the bits where, like, it's probably animation or music, but when Sally's singing her song and there's a head in the bass, in the double bass, in the hole in the double bass, there's just little touches that are just really nice. There's a lot of humour in there that's visual that you could quite easily completely miss if you weren't being taken in by all of it.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say on story?
There's two very distinct sort of halves. Well, not halves, but Halloween Land and Christmas Land. You know, anything that takes place in Christmas Land and real world land feels very different to what happens in Halloween Land. And it's a pleasant relief for me, for someone who's not a fan of this Halloween Land look and feel. It's really lovely to go to Christmas Land.
But even Christmas Land isn't pretty, is it? It's still got the undertones there in it.
Yeah,
well, that's where he said he was influenced by Dr. Seuss. And if you look at the drawings of Dr. Seuss, they're quite grotesque in their own ways.
Yeah, they are. But then you've got the... We're getting into art direction and animation here, aren't we? But then you've got the real world, which is all deliberately plain and geometric and sparse.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, let's go on to animation then.
Okay.
We can always dip back into story if we need
Why not? Yeah, that'll be nice and easy for me to edit.
No, you know, it's a discussion.
Actually, yes. I think we should conclude that, for me, I like the story. I think it's good. It's a guy who's is misguided, he's trying to find something else, and he realises that what he had was, you know, where he belongs.
And what a unique and clever idea from Tim Burton as well.
I really like the story. I like, we haven't really talked about it, but I like the performances as well. I think there's some great voice acting here. You know, like Catherine O'Hara. It's really strange to me, having seen her in films and the kind of person that she is and the kind of character she plays, for them to be doing a real character voice, or in fact doing two different really good characters.
Now, I didn't realise until today that she was Sally. I knew that she was Shock.
Yeah.
Lock, Shock and Barrel. There was a video like that came out like a year ago of Catherine O'Hara, Paul Rubens, and Danny Elfman performing the Lock, Shock and Barrel song.
Kidnap the Sandy Claus.
Kidnap the Sandy Claus. And a lot of the comments were saying, I was today years old when I found out that was Pee Wee Herman and stuff like that. Well, that was me last year. I was like, I don't admit it, but I didn't know either. But then today I found out that she was also Sally. And like you're saying, you don't think of her as that kind of role.
No. And, you know, we've talked about like Keanu Reeves and Jude Law and their voice acting ability. There is not a weak voice in this. They're all great character-led performances and really committed as well. I just think great performances all around in this.
And Paul Rubens is a hero of mine.
I know he is, yeah.
When he's Pee-wee, anyway, yeah.
Do you know, of the Tim Burton films, that's one that I haven't seen.
Pee Wee Herman.
Now we can talk about animation, if you like.
Yeah.
Who wants to go first?
Do you know what? I just want to say it's a masterpiece. It's Tim Burton's masterpiece. It really is. It's one of the most iconic films ever made. And, like, it's so Tim Burton that it's like, well, you know, sometimes you criticise films for being that, but this suits it because it's a cartoon, you know. It's just... It's incredible, this film.
It's the details, the little details for me. The one that I read about that probably fascinated me the most is the doorknob. So there's a bit where Jack goes and opens the door and he reaches out for the gold doorknob to open it. And that's still all the stop motion animation in the reflection of the doorknob. It took them weeks to sort out how they were going to manage this and get the right angle to be able to make it look right. But that level of detail. And the other thing that really stood out for me when I was watching it yesterday was during Sally's song, when she's holding onto the gate, the way that her fingers move on the gate, just the little movements, it is beautiful. Hauntingly beautiful is what it looks to me.
They've pushed the medium, the stop motion medium.
Absolutely.
This is like, you know, it probably wasn't ever seen to this level.
It creeps me out. It creeps me out. Now, I'm gonna keep being fair. I am fascinated by stop motion animation. I love the idea that the town hall building exists somewhere. Do you know what I mean? They've built it and it is 3 foot high and you can go and you can touch it and stroke it. I love that. Sorry, am I getting a little overexcited here?
Yeah.
And I love the detail that they've managed to put into the figures, but the overall look of the film is really aggressively not to my taste.
You don't like things that are grubby looking or dirty in any way, dingy.
No,
I do. I appreciate that the detail.
But it's like the spindliness of Jack's legs and his elbows. And I realise he's meant to be moving like a spider. And I know that is a conscious art decision. But for my eyes, I just don't find it aesthetically pleasing. And it's an entirely personal thing. I totally understand that. It's just not to my taste.
Get that. One of the things that I also love about it is, you know, it is undeniably Tim Burton. You look at any sketches, any concept art that he's done, the drawings with his poems and his books. This is it. Every single one of those characters looks like it's come straight out of one of his drawings. It has been superbly brought to life. And I totally understand where you're coming from. If that look and feel isn't to your taste, then you're not going to like it. You know, you said similar things with Sleeping Beauty, to be fair, and the visuals for that. If it doesn't strike a chord with you, it doesn't strike a chord. In this instance, I find it hard to find flaws in the way that this is animated, the way it's structured. When you look at those set pieces, as you said, that whole set, everything there existed in how many different sound stages was it? Like 20 or something? 28 was it?
And they all came apart in different segments, and they could walk between them. And yeah, there were
gaps
that.
And stuff like the Muppet, like they have for the Muppets, so they could get in and change things. There was something like 240 different heads just for Jack alone.
I mean, I love all that. I love all that, and I love that it was real and it existed somewhere. That really floats my boat as a fact. It's just an aesthetic choice that's not up my alley, really.
Mm. I think we should give a nod to the 2D animation. There's little of it, but the 2D animation that's in this is seriously some of the best 2D animation I've ever seen in my life. I know that sounds ridiculous.
You mean like the ghosts?
The ghosts at the start, and then Oogie Boogie in the moon.
And Santa as well.
The way Oogie Boogie turns into the bats, and then that last bit between his eyes just turns into kind of a bat itself. The 2D animator, I didn't write his name down, but he's on the Making of documentary on the DVD, and it's the movement of them are incredible, and it just adds that little extra je ne sais quoi.
It doesn't jar either with the stop motion pieces as well. It all just fits seamlessly.
They have ghosts carrying parcels, but they already animate the 3D parcels on wires, and then he drew ghosts on the top carrying them. Love it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, just back to the grubbiness of it that I'm not a fan of. Like when Oogie Boogie gets torn apart and he's nothing but insects inside.
Mm-hmm.
Awful.
Me and Bonnie found that fascinating.
I like it when the last one crawls up and Santa steps on it.
Yeah, I think it needs to be Santa at that point because he's not...
My bags, my bags!
He's not done much, has he?
No, not really, no.
So if he kills that last bug, but it almost seems like that's the most important bug, and if that bug survives, then Oogie Boogie will survive, but Santa gets him.
Little bits I really liked. I love the bits, the bit in What's This with all the different carol singers going, la, 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 and the bands flipping down as they go past. I love that. And Jack in the snowman.
Brilliant. And the way he moves, and he's like a spring.
Yeah.
And the segments of, he's like a pole in the middle of the snowman, and the segments move. Mm. They come apart in a really nice sort of concertina way.
I really love as well the bit when the public start calling the police, and it's got the policeman out is out of shot because of like the big light covering the way, and you can just see his hand tapping in the corner and stuff while he's talking on the phone. I love that whole bit, the way that that looks, and the more phones start appearing as more things happen. Really nice that.
I like the way the pipe bulges when they shove Santa down it into Oogie Boogie's lair. That's really satisfying, the way each segment between the... Yeah, each segment just sort of bulges out. It's lovely.
And the bit when the hill comes to life and unravels so it can walk down it. There's some really lovely bits.
I mean, even just like a hill can be that iconic.
It is.
A curly hill.
Yeah.
When you think of it, I think of him stood on that hill.
Yeah. In fact, I'm surprised looking at this DVD that isn't what's on the front of it.
Yeah, on the front we've got Jack and Sally, and then Lock, Shock and Barrel getting a mention on there. I didn't think they were quite that important, but
and then there's Jack's face as well, like just his general expressions because Disney wanted them to put eyes in him.
Yeah,
they insisted, and they were steadfast and said no, we can't do that because in stop motion it's a generally accepted thing that you need eyes there for people to be able to relate with the characters, but they were able to do that without it.
Whoever says that is wrong,
because
this works.
Yes.
And they're very expressive. They can be very open and seem innocent and friendly, and then in one frame, they'll put a bit of a brow on him, and he'll seem really menacing.
He's got an edge, hasn't he?
Mm.
He can turn it on.
Oh, yeah.
Look how thin he is. There's a musical of this. I mean, how can you...
Is there?
Yeah, you have to get someone who's tall and thin. Like, I know a guy called Dave who could... he's the closest I know to this shape.
It's that Disney anatomically incorrect thing all over again, isn't it?
Yeah. We've met him in Disneyland Paris, haven't we?
I missed him.
As Santa Claus.
Yeah, Bonnie met him and she was unsure about him, but eventually she agreed to go and talk to him because he was being really friendly. And then that night, she was sat on a bed in the Davy Crockett Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Is it called Ranch?
Yeah.
And she'd obviously been thinking about it all day and she said, "Daddy, I think I've decided that he wasn't real because I could see his teeth, but then he had teeth painted above them." And bless her, she'd been thinking about it all day.
He's a funny character to me, isn't he? Because of that, it doesn't quite look right. And I understand why, because he's a very chatty character, so he's probably right that he's one of the ones that would talk.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, looks wise, it should just be the head, really.
They've given him a rubber head from the cheekbones upwards. Mm.
It looks like he's put a balloon over his mouth and thrown it up.
Yeah, I think it looks quite good, because we're adults and we kind of know what the scar is. And they think, oh, that's a good costume. But to a child where there is actual suspension of disbelief, it's not quite good enough, is it? No.
Yeah, that's definitely one of those, you know, we're not going to meet Jack Skellington, we're going to meet a man dressed like him.
Yeah, yeah. And his legs and arms are not impossibly thin either.
Any more on animation?
Other than I think it's a masterpiece, no?
No, just that little old thing.
It's just a masterpiece.
I mean, I could catalogue the things that freak me the fudge out, but like him lifting up his head and scratching his brain.
Yeah.
Didn't like that.
See, I find that funny.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. This isn't I think they should cut that bit out. It's just I don't like it. That character's flappy mouth and the way he kind of manages to move one side of it independently of the other freaks me out. That character that's got teeth go all the way around its head and the middle of it is like a stick freaks me out.
Oh, yeah, that is a bit odd.
Freaks me out.
Hasn't Sally got a nice leg? You know when she like tempts Oogie Boogie with it?
Ooh, yeah.
What have we even though it's like, all stitched together, like, it's nice.
The
leg.
Length of Sally's neck compared to the chubbiness of her shoulders freaks me out. There's it's just a catalogue of things that just make my skin crawl a bit. I think that's the point. I think they've achieved what they wanted to achieve. And there is no criticism of Tim Burton and his team for freaking me out. It's entirely my problem, not theirs. But freak me out, they did.
See, I always think when you watch a film or when you go and see something on stage or whatever it might be, you're there to be entertained. And entertainment doesn't always mean being in your comfort zone.
No, absolutely.
I think it's important to sometimes be scared, sometimes be upset, sometimes feel happy. And all those emotions are an important part of it. Also, if it's achieving that with you, then it's doing something
absolutely
right.
Art should prompt a reaction.
Music.
Oh, we're going to have problems with this.
Oh, no, really?
Go on then, Lucy, talk. Go on.
It's very Sondheim.
Ah, that's interesting. The elements, I would say it's more operatic. I would say it's almost more GNS soliloquies.
Okay.
I know what you mean by that. Some of it is difficult, but it's not as complicated as Sondheim.
But I
think it's more off-putting and divisive, perhaps, like Sondheim. But I don't think it's sort of...
They're all nice tunes, though.
Oh, I think they are. I agree. I can understand why people might not like it and find it troublesome. I think you've said before that...
It's inaccessible. I think that's what it is.
That's the word I'm looking for.
I think a lot of it, though, a lot of that inaccessibility isn't down to the songs themselves. I think if it was sung in a normal way without it being a character, if it was orchestrated... In a more standard way, you would see these as really nice songs, but they're deliberately juxtaposing everything to try and make it sound awkward. But they then put in This Is Halloween, and they put in What's This, which are absolute barnstorming songs.
Yeah, those two songs, and to an extent, although I don't like it, but Oogie Boogie's song as well, they really describe what they need to describe in terms of story, in tone, they set it. And the little bits of incidental music you get, like the discordant version of Jingle Bells, brass quartet or whatever you want to call that play, are all really, really good. It's I've forgotten his name. It's Jack Skellington's solo songs, or except for What's This, the opening one, the one he does in the graveyard, the one he does when he's trying to get Christmas right. They keep breaking cadence. You struggle to find a 4-bar phrase in it. It's really difficult to listen to. And I appreciate that it can be challenging. Inaccessible is a very good word for it. Now, if you really listen to it, I imagine it's more fun to perform than to listen to, because there is a lot of heart there. There is a lot of meaning there. But to a casual first-time listener, it is very messy music. Very messy music.
This is Halloween. What's This, an Oogie Boogie song, have all been done by the aforementioned voice player like. I don't know. One of them must be obsessed with this film, but they've done 3 videos on YouTube voice play. I'm not so keen on the Oogie Boogie one, but
no,
they do some cracking versions, especially This Is Halloween. Just wanted to point that out.
Which opens with the grim grinning ghosts music playing as the
Door opens. Yeah, very quietly. Yeah, though, just barely even notice it. But I think with this, I think you're right. There's these standout songs, there's these pillars, and then it's interspersed with these almost forgettable ones. And I could understand criticism of that, but I think in the moment I like them and they work.
Well, you see, just the first one. You have This Is Halloween, and that's not very Jack-centric. At the end of it, Jack sets himself on fire and then comes out of a well, doesn't he?
I love that. Like, yeah, that's what great. Is that? Like, is that, have they made him? Like, where is he in that? Is he in disguise?
I think that's his interesting costume.
I watched a quick thing on YouTube today of a guy saying, who is Jack Skellington? You know, he was obviously alive at some point, so who was he when he was alive? And he traces it all back to the Headless Horseman.
Oh,
basically saying that, you know, their paths are very, very similar. They both got pumpkin heads, or wear pumpkin heads instead of their own and stuff. So maybe the fire is the same as the fire of the pumpkin being thrown in Ichabod.
But then, like, rising out of that well, you know, that's his entrance. It's a great entrance.
It's great.
Because you don't realise that scarecrow is him.
No.
So that scarecrow can do it once, and then as long as it disappears, that gets submerged and then reappears, it can do a proper entrance then.
So, I mean, you have that to start with, and then there's this short scene where everyone's saying, "Great Halloween this year, Jack." Yes, 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 yes. And then almost immediately, it goes into that really, really personal monologuing thing, and it feels too soon for the character. It feels... It's again, it's a very messy song. It keeps changing. There's bits of it that are good, but you really have to listen hard to it to appreciate the content.
I will say I don't remember that song, but watching it today, I enjoyed it.
And it's long.
It's not that long, though. It's not that long at all. And not only that, when you get to the end of that piece, he's there about to go into Christmas land. I really like it. Personally, I really like it, but I like that kind of soliloquy. Again, I say GNS. It is. It's like those bits you get them in GNS songs where people are basically singing when they would talk, and that's what he's doing. It's not really a song as such, but it does have a tune, and it's repetitive, and it's used again and again. There are definitely verses in there. I like it. I really like it, and I think it sets the tone of the other pieces as well. So, Sally's song as well has a similar feel to it. It's much more tuneful, I would say, but it's got a similar feel to it.
That would be... normally, that moment in a musical would be the sort of, oh, God. Look, you know, the sneaking a look at your watch. But, because I enjoy that melody so much.
Yeah.
For once I didn't get that. I just enjoy that song.
But you couldn't have big big power ballads from them or anything like that. It wouldn't, any other music in those points wouldn't have worked at all in the tone of the film.
I mean, it does fit because the film is grotesque and uncomfortable, and so the fact that the music is discordant and grotesque and uncomfortable kind of fits very well within it. But again, personal...
I don't find it grotesque.
Personal taste, it's not for me. I find it hard to listen to.
Do you like Kidnap the Sandy Claws?
With Pee Wee Herman!
Okay, we're going to kidnap the Sandy Claws
and then put him in a bag!
There's a good... Oh yeah, I like the line in Something's Up with Jack. I mean, say what you like about that, but that's catchy, isn't it? Something's Up with Jack. What's that line? It's sorry, I've just lost my place. He's all alone. He's all alone up there, locked away inside. Never says a word. Hope he hasn't died. That kid says. That's the sense of humour I like in this.
Yeah.
And of course, the
something's up with Jack.
We haven't said it, but Jack Skellington's, I presume you both know, Jack Skellington's voice is Danny Elfman singing.
Voice, I don't think I knew that until two or three years ago, and it's one of those things that when you first hear that, it blew my mind because I didn't know Danny Elfman had such a beautiful voice.
I mean, it's exceptionally good vocals, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
And it matches
good.
So well, matches with, really with, well the, yeah. with the yeah, spoken yeah. version. But well, also, having said that, though, the spoken one does do a really good performance.
The spoken one was cast retrospectively. It's actually Susan Sarandon's first husband, Chris Sarandon.
Yeah.
Chris Sarandon. They cast Elfman first because, of course, he'd done all the demos for the songs and they wanted to keep him. And then they cast a speaking voice to match Elfman, not the other way around.
Right, okay.
Makes sense.
That makes sense. And then now I feel less sorry for Chris Sarandon.
I feel like he sings more than he talks anyway.
Yeah, but maybe. I feel less sorry for Chris Sarandon because if he'd been cast as a speaking voice and his singing wasn't good enough and then Danny Elfman had to step in, that would have been like, you know, sad. But if he's just, you know, told from the off, we've got a singing voice, we need a spoken voice. But I wonder why Danny Elfman couldn't do the spoken bit. Is he just not...
He probably could have done, but...
I bet he could.
They'd written all the music first. So they'd already done that and so that's what they shot first. They shot all the musical numbers and all that bit first and were still waiting for the script.
Because Danny Elfman plays Barrel, doesn't he? So he can act. We have to talk about What's This though separately. Because I don't just think it's one of the best Disney songs they've got. I think it's one of the best Christmas songs ever written.
It is a great Christmas song.
One of the best songs ever written. It's brilliant.
Everything bad I've said about this, not bad. Every point I've said I don't like this film, I do love the whole sequence. I love the look of Christmas Town. I love the music. I love the way it's, if I can use the word, choreographed. I love the whole sequence of What's This.
That song is incredible, though. Don't you think?
It is. It's great.
And the intro to that, as it goes into it, is beautiful. Or as you would say, Chris, beautiful.
Beautiful.
Because you're...
Not as Yorkshire as everybody else. Yeah. I'm hiding my Yorkshire. It is beautiful. Mm. I agree. There's something, by the way, and this isn't music at all, but there's something that he does in that, which Sally does as well later on, which is he goes around the back of a wall somewhere and just kind of almost like flops down to the ground in wonder with everything going on around him.
Mm.
And Sally does that later on when she's thinking about him. I think it might even be during the song. But it's a really nice visual of that kind of almost taking the thoughts internal and stuff. I just really like it.
I like it when he falls into the snow in that song as well, and because he's so spindly, he just disappears into it.
And picks up a handful and eats it. Or is that earlier?
I think that's earlier.
I like when he does that.
Yeah, that's music.
Well,
I think that's the music.
Tell us about money and stuff, if you've got any money stuff.
Oh, no, I don't have money and stuff.
Oh!
I know the answer.
Oh, sorry.
I know what it made.
Just before we move on, we've got to talk about You're Joking, the Oogie Boogie song.
Hmm.
Because, actually, not keen on that one. I never have been. And I always kind of go... And actually, I was saying, you know, like a lull in a musical where you go, oh, it's a love song at, like, what, 10 to 10? Are you kidding me? For me, Oogie Boogie is that one. I'm like, I'm not interested in it. I couldn't tell you why.
I quite like it.
The style of it, it just doesn't appeal to me. I like the visuals, I like the neon, but I don't know.
That's interesting, going blacklight. I know we're going back to art and animation now. Do you think that was actually filmed under a blacklight to get that effect?
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
Because
yeah.
That's a very strange choice, really.
It's great, it looks
It does
amazing.
Look good.
You're joking! Don't do it for me. Do you like it?
I do quite like it. I don't think it's the great song that some people that the guy on our
the guy in the list of our list songs,
said it was.
Yeah, Oogie Boogie. Oh, no.
Yeah, that made the top 30, whereas none of the other songs did. But I do think it's good.
The guy was a troublemaker.
Yes. I do know about money, and it isn't as big as I thought it was going to be, because I was watching something about it the other day. It made somewhere around about 56 million, and since then it's gone up to about 75-ish million from...
I think it was a sleeper hit. I don't think it was a massive hit the year that it was released, but it's become cult.
Yeah, it's
afterwards.
Definitely got a cult status, hasn't it?
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm just looking up my IMDb scores.
Do
now.
It, you look them up.
Any final thoughts just while I do this?
I got a few like little favourite bits. I like the snake moving through the dice.
Yes, I like that.
Or the die, if you will. I like the awful rendition of Jingle Bells, as we mentioned. And I like that in Making Christmas. One of the characters near the start of that song just walks by with a wheelbarrow and he just goes, Making Christmas. Very casually.
Did you like the grotesque Mickey?
Don't remember that. So, I know what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, so the two kids come in.
I didn't think of that as Mickey, but...
Oh, well, no, it very deliberately is.
It is, isn't it?
So two, and so one of them gets that and the other one gets the duck, the killer duck.
Yeah.
And the girl is dressed in Mickey pyjamas. And the boy is dressed in Donald Duck pyjamas.
You're very observant, Christopher.
No, I watched a video that told me.
Oh.
I think the...
I mean, yes, I am.
Cheetah, pumpkin eater.
The details are where the gold is in this film.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic.
Speaking
right.
of which, the head in the bass guitar was Danny Elfman. In the double bass, sorry. The head in the double bass is Danny Elfman.
I'm sure the one that says something about...
Oh, and another detail.
I'm sure one of those band members is Paul Rubens as well, because it sounded a bit Pee Wee Herman-y.
Oh, maybe. Zero, who we haven't even spoken about.
Oh, we've got Zum Zum on the table of Zero, and he's got a little doghouse as well.
Oh. Zero's nose is a jack-o'-lantern. But you'd have to look very close at it to be able to actually see that.
If you look at the Zum Zum... You're right.
Oh, is it? Oh, there we go. That's good.
It's a very small Zum Zum. It's one of those Zum Zum swishes, but... Yeah, I always thought of it as red. But yeah,
I did, because he does the Rudolph bit, doesn't he?
Which is ace as well. Oh, I forgot about that. It's all Misty. Who's going to ride my sleigh?
It's a nice
who's
touch,
ride my
it?
Sleigh tonight? Oh, yeah, that whole takeoff
and
bit.
And Sally makes
so
that,
much hope there.
Sally
for
makes
it.
That happen by trying to stop him, but she actually creates something quite beautiful.
Oh, I tell you what, I do like. I do like that the crazy brain scratching man who I don't like gets a bride just like himself at the end. That's nice. That's happy.
With half of his brain.
Yeah. Well, that's what me and you are like, Huey.
Yeah.
Half a brain each.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes, go.
Okay. IMDb have bucked the trend.
Woo-hoo!
Have given 7 point something and has given it 8.0.
8.0.
Well, that is big for IMDb.
8.1?
0.
Rotten Tomatoes has given it a critic score of 95% and an audience score of 91%.
Okay.
So these are really high scores from everybody.
Not
really.
As high as my scores, baby.
Let's see where we're going with you guys.
Story. Hugh?
I give it a 10, baby. I don't see any problems with it. It's really well paced. I love the idea of this out of place guy who's trying to find something and he thinks he's found it and he messes it up, and it's funny that he's getting it all so horribly wrong because he's applying what he thinks he should be to it. It's brilliant. I loved it. It's 10.
I've given it an 8. I don't get overly excited about it. I think there's problems with the storytelling through song. But it's good, and it's got a moral. 8.
This sits just so perfectly in the kind of films that I love, that I've grown up loving, the kind of films that don't get made anymore. And for that reason, I've given it a 10.
Animation. Chris, back at you.
It's flawless. I mean, it is absolutely flawless. The level of detail, the amount of effort that people have gone to make that happen. It took them 3 years to make it, and you can see why. And it's not like one of these films where they've gone at it and then left it and come back to it and left it. It is just brilliant. So I've given it a 1. I mean a 10, sorry.
I've also given it a 10. The advancement in that medium, you know, and also the other elements going in, the 2D, the craftsmanship, the level of detail, I can't fault it. It's got to be a 10. Mm-hmm.
I get very excited about the level of skill here. I get very excited about thinking about them actually doing it. But as I've explained, it's just misses the mark with me on a personal level. And we've discussed on this podcast before whether we should work Mark personally or Mark objectively.
Happy medium.
Happy medium. I've given it a 9.
Oh, that's good.
Is that better than you thought?
Yeah.
Well, I'm being fair. It is amazing. It's only not a 10 because it's just not for me.
Hmm. So that brings us on to music. I can appreciate some of the problems with it. And even me personally, you know, I would say some of the songs are forgettable. But as I'm watching it, I just find it so enjoyable. And the quality of This Is Halloween, What's This? Maybe, you know, to some extent, Sandy Claus. And I'm giving it a 9. I love it.
Me? You?
Yeah.
Me?
You?
I love Sondheim.
I know. We always have this argument.
But I don't think it's very Sondheim. I think people would say it's like Sondheim because they find Sondheim inaccessible. And this is perceived as inaccessible. But I absolutely love it. It's got two of the best Disney songs ever in it, I think. Songs that get stuck in my head more than any others. It's got some great little resuscitative soliloquies going on in there. It's just got so much. And the whole, you know, what Danny Elfman does incredibly well as well is he scores a film just superbly. There are only a handful of people who do it as well as he does, I think, in the business. I'm giving it another 10.
Boom!
And I've literally just decided that.
Wow.
Okay, I think there is many, many very, very strong elements of the music. What's This being an absolute seminal point, really. But they then get equally dragged down by long, inaccessible songs that I find a bit self-indulgent of Danny Elfman and sometimes poorly paced and poorly placed choice of music. So that's been dragged down to a 7.
What did those the horrible little children of ours think?
We just watched The Nightmare Before Christmas. There's a pumpkin at the beginning and it turns into Jack the Skeleton.
So Jack Skeleton went into the woods and he found this doll with a Christmas tree on, and he goes into Christmas Town and he wants to steal Santa's place.
He wants to be Santa, so he gets his naughty kids to trap him, and then he has a look what he's missing and then gets everyone to make everything into Christmas. He goes to the real world. He gives out presents, but they're not good. They attack the children.
And he did it, but then it all went horribly wrong. And Santa had to save the day. And they all lived happily ever after. Super Santa! To the rescue! rescue. My favourite bit was when Santa saved the day.
I even like the head in the box with the boy.
My favourite character is Jack Skeleton.
Why?
I don't know.
My favourite character was Jack.
My favourite song was... What's this? What's this?
What's this? What's this? There's my things in the air.
I would give it a 4 out of 5.
I would give it a 4 out of 5. I like it. Merry Christmas!
Wow, guys. That's a big score.
That's not overtaken Mary Poppins, has it?
Of 91.
What did Mary Poppins get?
Well, Bambi's a 90.
Mary Poppins was 92, isn't it?
Wasn't Bambi at the... Oh, Mary Poppins was at the top.
Yeah.
At 92. Ooh. So, nestled between Mary Poppins and Bambi is The Nightmare Before Christmas at 91.
I'm very comfortable with that.
I am. It's deserved.
Although I'm starting to feel a little bit sorry for the golden era films that are starting to slide down from that top.
Yeah, spot. I know what you mean, because you kind of want them to be that iconic, but the truth is, in my own life, they're not the films that I would put top necessarily. I'm comfortable with that. If it had overtaken Mary Poppins, I might have pouted a bit.
I can see why I've scored them both the same score for very similar
reasons. Did you do 10, 10, 10 for both?
Yeah.
Right.
I think for what they are and the style of film they are, there's nothing better than them. So I'm very comfortable with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cry factor, Hugh.
It's absolutely beautiful.
She really loves it. I don't know why they just can't be together.
Hugh's cry factor.
Let me tell you about the cry factor. It's low, guys. When Sandy Claus wishes Jack a happy Halloween at the end and he makes it snow, you know, that's kind of nice. Mm. And the duet with Jack and Sally at the end is sweet, but that's about as emotional as it gets. So just a little two.
Just a little two.
Okay, I have a little quote from Walt here before we go.
We need a little jingle for this.
We need a jingle.
It's Walt's quote. Something like that. Maybe not that.
Get a good idea and stay with it. Dog it and work it until it's done and do it right. Bosh. Thanks, Walt. We'll all live by that.
Cheers, Walt.
Dogging.
Dogging.
Dog it.
Oh.
My mistake. Well... It's that time of day when we decide to go home and get some sleep and stuff because it's late. Mm. Oh no, we already are home.
That's true.
So we don't need to go to sleep.
We need to dampen that fire down.
Let me start again then. Well, it's that time of day when we dampen the fire down and we could go to sleep, but it's Christmas, so we probably might just have another drink instead.
Baileys.
And party
the night
away.
Lovely little Baileys.
A mint Baileys.
Ooh, interesting.
Oh, no, caramel. Salted caramel Baileys.
Ooh.
It's the future.
Or an Amarula.
Oh, I like an Amarula.
Right then, bye.
Bye now.
Good night, John.